Welcome to the Political Rewind. I'm Madhani Maturi. Today, a tour of Indiana's earmark trail. But first, to the victor go the spoils. Democrats flex their majority muscle all over the budget.
It was just a few months ago that President Obama was hoping for bipartisan support for his priorities. Now, in the face of opposition, he may have to resort to different tactics. The president's budget calls for the government to spend $3.6 trillion. That's more than any president has ever proposed. One question now is whether Democrats should seek Republican votes or if they'll use a budget rule that allows them to do without those votes. NPR's David Wilna has the story.
Hashing out a non-binding budget resolution that the president doesn't even have to sign may not seem the most rewarding way to spend your time if you're a lawmaker. But just listen to Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi.
The budget process is very exciting.
Majority Leader Harry Reid had one more observation yesterday on the Senate floor.
As we work our way through the budget process this week, Democrats and Republicans will not agree on everything.
That may be the understatement of the month. At the White House yesterday, President Obama described his budget as transformational.
The budget is a comprehensive strategy to grow this economy. We will attack the problems that have held us back for too long. The high cost of health care, the budget deficit, our broken education system, and our energy dependence.
But here's how Judd Gregg, the top Republican on the Senate Budget Committee, described that same budget.
What's being proposed here is a massive increase in taxes in order to massively increase the size of the government and have virtually no fiscal discipline on the side of borrowing.
What Republican lawmakers really object to in the Obama budget is the creation of potentially costly new government programs, such as universal health care coverage or a cap and trade plan. But many Democrats consider such initiatives essential and want to shield them from potentially fatal Senate filibusters through a budget maneuver called reconciliation.
Reconciliation, for most people, is a husband and wife getting together and working out their marriage problems.
That's budget expert Stan Collender. He says budget reconciliation has helped controversial legislation, such as the two big Bush tax cuts, by requiring only 51 votes to pass in the Senate rather than the usual 60. And because Senate Democrats are two votes shy of 60, Collender says reconciliation could be very useful to them.
It may, in fact, be the only way Obama can get things done, unless he can convince a couple of Republicans to vote with the Democrats and then, of course, hold all the Democrats.
Not surprisingly, Senate Republicans are not happy about the prospect of seeing reconciliation used to strip them of their ability to filibuster, which is the most powerful tool the minority has to stop legislation. Here's Missouri's Kit Bond.
In this postpartisan time of Barack Obama, we're seeing a little Chicago politics. They steamroller those who disagree with them, and then, I guess in Chicago, they coat them in cement and drop them in the river.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says Democrats may want to think twice about resorting to reconciliation to pass big controversial bills.
It's a big gamble, because if you do it with no bipartisan buy-in at all, you own the whole thing politically.
Some Democrats, too, have doubts. Senate Budget Committee Chairman Kent Conrad has already come out against using reconciliation in his budget.
I don't think it is a particularly wise course.
Conrad points out that anything in a bill protected by reconciliation that's not related to mandatory spending or taxing can be challenged in the Senate.
So when you start to try to write substantive legislation and major parts of it can be stricken, you're left with what the parliamentarian described last week as Swiss cheese legislation.
Still, House Democrats may include reconciliation in their budget plan, and the White House says it's not off the table. But Rutgers University congressional expert Ross Baker warns reconciliation could carry a high political price.
To use it basically as a battering ram to get through the president's budget intact, I think is pretty bare-knuckles politics.
A decision to use the reconciliation protections could prove highly effective for passing some big bills, Baker says. But he adds it could also deal a death blow to bipartisanship. David Wilna, NPR News.
The budget battles have officially started. President Obama was on Capitol Hill today and on TV last night, pushing his spending plan. Democratic leaders of the House and Senate released their budgets today. These are blueprints for actual spending bills to come later in the year, but they force politicians to put real numbers on paper setting priorities for the government. And as NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports, this year's budget represents a major shift in those priorities.
It is a signal of how bad the economic situation is that one of the most committed fiscal conservatives in Congress said this today.
Now, it's all but impossible to balance the budget when the economy is in recession. And for that matter, it's also not advisable.
South Carolina's John Spratt, the Democratic chairman of the House Budget Committee. He has been a sharp-eyed deficit hawk. But today, he agreed with President Obama's view that pushing cash into the economy is necessary for recovery, even though over the next 5 years it means spending trillions of dollars the government doesn't have. To Congressman Paul Ryan, the top Republican on the Budget Committee, it is a strategy that sounds old-fashioned at best.
With this budget, the president and the Democratic majority are attempting nothing less than the third and great final wave of government expansion, building on the Great Society and the New Deal.
Democrats on the Budget Committee hailed the big increases for education and renewable energy. This budget also establishes so-called reserve funds. These are places in the budget where lawmakers can store saved money to be used later on big priorities, like a health care overhaul and energy independence. For Democrats representing rural areas, there was also good news.
We hadn't heard a president in 8 years say the word infrastructure.
Arkansas Democrat Marion Barry.
It is such a relief to have a president that understands that if you don't make the necessary investments in education and infrastructure, no matter what else happens, you have absolutely no reason to expect that anything's going to get any better.
And as those deficit hawks on the committee pointed out, the budget does cut annual deficits to about half their current size in 5 years. Now, it may sound like your typical partisan fight, Democrats against Republicans, blue versus red. But when it comes to fiscal issues, there is a fuzzy purple area where the parties overlap. Fiscal conservatives who are social moderates, they're caught in the middle in this debate, especially the so-called blue dog Democrats.
I want to make a plea to a special select audience.
Republican Paul Ryan.
I want to ask my friends, the blue dog Democrats, do you really want all this government? Do you want your fingerprints on this massive and unprecedented growth in our national debt?
Conservative Democrats are getting hit from the left as well.
It's what's wrong with Wall Street and Washington. AIG executives get millions in bonuses after running their company into the ground, and we get to pay for it.
And these blows are hitting home, literally. This is a radio ad sponsored by the liberal advocacy group MoveOn.org that is running in the home districts of 10 Democrats who are fiscal conservatives.
President Obama's new budget will make Wall Street pay its fair share and use the savings to invest in energy, education, and health care.
The ad aims to get voters to pressure conservative Democrats to support this budget. And if you're feeling a little deja vu, it's because it does sound just like a campaign commercial from last year. This time, though, the vote everyone will be watching will be in Congress on the budget, scheduled for next week. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, The Capitol.
I'm Madhani Maturi, and it's the Political Rewind. Finally today, a trip to Indiana's pork trail. And we don't mean barbecue.
We now turn to members of Congress who just can't get enough, government money that is, in the form of earmarks. The new spending bill is stuffed with 8,600 of them. One big reason Congress hasn't reined in the special provisions is that voters love them so long as the money is coming into their district. NPR's Peter Overby has been tracking some of that congressional earmark money. He followed the earmark trail to Northwest Indiana and the district of Congressman Peter Visklosky.
Longtime residents call this corner of Indiana the region. Just outside Chicago, it's the industrial Democratic stronghold in a rural Republican state. It's Rust Belt country. Steel mills used to dominate the landscape along Lake Michigan and the job market as well. That changed 25 years ago. The economy hasn't yet recovered. Democrat Peter Visklosky has been on the House Appropriations Committee for 18 years. He's known as a thoughtful appropriator and strong on the often neglected job of oversight. But the earmark watchdogs at Taxpayers for Common Sense also pegged Visklosky as one of the top 10 earmarkers in the House. So my first stop on the earmark trail was at a flood control project on the Little Calumet River in Hammond, Indiana. Next to a little two-lane bridge is a new dirt levee. It's part of the earmark. Tom McDermott, the mayor of Hammond, met me there and told me about the flood last fall. 4 straight days of rain.
You couldn't even see the bridge. It was really sad. I mean, you could literally see the water, like, up to the middle of the windows on all the houses, like, all through here.
We walked all over the earmark. McDermott pointed out new flood walls across from the levee.
Now, the reason this has to do with Congressman Pete is Pete Visklosky's had this money waiting for us.
Just last year, Visklosky appropriated $14.7 million for Little Cal flood control. McDermott is also the Democratic chairman in Lake County. He says Visklosky sticks up for his people, their homes, and their jobs.
People respect him so much. It's just, it's almost sacrilege to challenge him.
Almost. Visklosky has run for Congress 13 times. One time, he got less than 65% of the vote. But back to the earmark trail. Stop two was Purdue University's Calumet campus, where a Visklosky earmark helps the steel industry. Big steel is not gone from here. The mills make more steel than ever before, just with fewer workers. Northwest Indiana now leads the nation in steel production. Visklosky's earmark finances a university program to analyze and improve steel production methods. Professor Chen Zhao is in charge of the program.
Not too many people doing this in the country.
Zhao says steelmakers all over the country bring their problems here. The technology looks like a video game on steroids. Research engineer Bin Wu gave me some 3D glasses.
You can choose this one or this one. I think this one is more comfortable.
And then we all stood there, facing a screen maybe 5 feet tall, as a virtual blast furnace appeared. The furnace glided toward us, and we floated inside, past clumps of fuel, something obviously not possible in real life.
So here comes the most important part.
It's about changing the fuel, going from pure coke to a mix of coke and pulverized coal, which is cheaper and cleaner. Last month, Congress gave the center another $4.7 million. I asked Chen Zhao about Visklosky.
Has he ever come by to
see? He was here October 7th. He told us, even I understand the process now. He thinks it's really, really useful, and what he said is very consistent with what the industry people told us, too.
Another rave review. And on to the third stop on the earmark trail. The Purdue Technology Center is an incubator for high-tech startup firms. Visklosky provided the funding. One tenant is Nuvant Systems, founded in 1999 by a chemistry professor, Eugene Smotkin.
The focus of Nuvant Systems is portable fuel cells, in particular portable fuel cells that use liquid fuels.
Nuvant is developing new lighter systems to replace old technology derived from the more mainstream hydrogen air fuel cells. Smotkin's been working with the Defense Department for years. He moved to Indiana because Nuvant got a federal small business grant, and the state of Indiana matched it. The Purdue Technology Center built a laboratory for Nuvant to lease. And then Nuvant got two Visklosky earmarks of its own. They changed Nuvant's standing in the industry. Smotkin says he used to lose workers to big corporations all the time.
I would have students halfway through their PhD program suddenly come to me and say, Gene, I got a job offer at General Motors. I can't turn this down.
Thanks to the earmark money,
I was able to offer very good health plans and pay salaries that are some of the best in Indiana.
And even in this economy, Nuvant is hiring.
Neither this newspaper nor the people here are telling Pete Visklosky to keep our money in Washington. No, that would be foolish.
Rich James is the editorial page editor at the Post Tribune, one of the local papers. He said that right now Visklosky's actually in a bit of earmark trouble. Quite a few of the earmark recipients hired the same lobbyists, the PMA group. The firm specialized in earmarks, and several lawmakers, including Visklosky, have ties to it. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, PMA donors have given Visklosky more campaign money than any other source. Federal agents raided PMA last fall. It seems to be part of a probe of earmarks and campaign cash. Visklosky recently got rid of $18,000, contributions from 3 questionable PMA donors. His campaign donated that much to the U.S. Treasury. And how much did the PMA story register in Indiana? Rich James says people noticed.
The PMA thing kind of was out of character for him. And I don't want to say he's tainted, but he's always been above that.
Then again,
if you were to ask me, is that association going to hurt his chances for re-election? No.
Finally, the earmark trail led back to Capitol Hill. At Taxpayers for Common Sense, Steve Ellis said there's only one way for taxpayers to trust congressional earmarks.
If we actually had a comprehensive merit-based system where we were figuring out what are the best and the most important things to be spending our taxpayer dollars on, not the most politically important.
Visclosky himself keeps an extremely low profile, not unusual for an appropriator. His spokesman said they would have to decline comment for this piece. But for every earmark skeptic like Steve Ellis, there seem to be thousands of voters grateful for what their lawmakers do locally with federal dollars. One of my nights in Indiana, the waiter at the restaurant asked what brought me there. We started talking about Visclosky, and the waiter said what everyone seems to say. The congressman looks out for his district. Or, as the waiter put it, Pete is awesome. Peter Overby, NPR News.
Thanks for listening to The Political Rewind. If you want more, and you know you do, go to NPR's politics page at npr.org.